In the vast landscape of epic fantasy, few works have achieved the depth and staying power of Tad Williams' To Green Angel Tower. As the concluding volume of the Memory, Sorrow, and Thorn trilogy, this massive tome, often split into two parts for paperback release, represents one of the most influential works in modern fantasy. George R. R. Martin has openly credited Williams' series as a direct inspiration for A Song of Ice and Fire, noting how it showed him that epic fantasy could transcend Tolkien-esque tropes to explore complex political machinations and moral ambiguity. Published in 1993, after 6 years of writing, the book became an instant New York Times bestseller and cemented Williams' reputation as a master storyteller. Its legacy continues to resonate through contemporary fantasy, with writers like Patrick Rothfuss and Christopher Paolini citing its influence on their own world-building approaches. Let's journey through this masterpiece that redefined what epic fantasy could achieve. The story opens with the world of Ostenard teetering on the brink of catastrophe. King Elias, once celebrated as a promising ruler who would continue his father Prester John's legacy of peace, has fallen under the malevolent influence of two dark forces. The Red Priest, Prirates, a manipulative sorcerer whose crimson robes match the blood on his hands, and the spectral Storm King, Inaluki. As the first Sithi to ever embrace darkness, Inaluki's transformation from a noble immortal to a being of pure hatred serves as a dark mirror of Elias's own corruption. An unnatural winter grips the land with unprecedented ferocity, bringing starvation and despair to every corner of the realm. Farmers watch helplessly as crops wither beneath sheets of killing frost, while city dwellers fight over dwindling food supplies. Prince Joshua, Elias's younger brother and the kingdom's last hope, leads a desperate band of refugees who have found temporary sanctuary atop the Stone of Farewell, an ancient Sithi holy place whose weathered stones still hum with old magic. The refugees' situation grows more precarious by the day as supplies dwindle and the Storm King's forces draw ever closer. The narrative brilliantly weaves together multiple storylines, each following characters whose fates are inextricably linked to the three great swords: Memory, also known as Brightnail, Sorrow, and Thorn. These ancient weapons, forged in an age when magic flowed more freely through the world, hold tremendous power that may either save or destroy all of Ostenard. King Elias wields Sorrow, a blade forged from otherworldly materials that slowly corrupts his mind and soul, feeding his paranoia and cruelty. The blade's black metal seems to drink in light itself, and those who stand near it speak of hearing whispered voices. The heroes have recovered Thorn from the frozen wastes of the north, where it lay guarded by fearsome creatures for centuries, while Brightnail remains hidden in Prester John's tomb beneath the Hayholt Castle. Williams masterfully builds tension by showing how the Storm King's influence spreads across Ostenard like a cancer. Ancient wards and protective magics fail one by one, allowing horrors long imprisoned to walk free again. The unnatural winter deepens, turning once fertile valleys into graves of ice. Strange creatures emerge from ancient hiding places, twisted beings that should exist only in nightmare tales told to frighten children. The immortal Norns, cousins to the Sithi who followed Inaluki into darkness, prepare for a final war against mortals from their mountain stronghold of Stormspike. Through vivid descriptions of barren fields, desperate refugees, and eerie supernatural manifestations, Williams creates a palpable sense of apocalyptic dread that permeates every page. Villages lie abandoned, their inhabitants fled or frozen where they stood. Ancient forests whisper with voices that shouldn't exist, and the very stars seem dimmer in the winter-cursed sky. As one character observes while watching frost creep across the windows of a once warm hall, the world itself seems to be dying, a simple statement that captures the existential threat facing all of Ostenard, where even the very cycle of seasons has been broken by the Storm King's power. At the heart of this sprawling epic stands Simon, once a kitchen scullion in the Hayholt Castle, now knighted for his bravery and bearing a distinctive white streak in his red hair, a mark from his encounter with the great dragon Yggdrasil. Simon's transformation from naive boy to reluctant hero forms the emotional core of the narrative, offering readers a deeply relatable perspective on extraordinary events. His early days in the castle kitchens, dodging the stern housekeeper Rachel's wooden spoon and dreaming of adventure while shirking his duties, establish him as an everyman figure whose ordinary struggles ground the story's epic scope. What makes Simon's journey so compelling is that it subverts traditional fantasy tropes. Unlike many fantasy protagonists who discover special powers or royal lineage that instantly elevates them, Simon's growth comes through painful experience, loss, and the gradual accumulation of wisdom. His heroism emerges not from supernatural abilities, but from his fundamental decency and willingness to persevere despite overwhelming odds. The death of his mentor Morgan is, the bitter cold of his flight through Aldeort Forest, and the loss of innocence that comes with his first kill, each challenge shapes him without fundamentally changing his essential nature. In one particularly moving sequence, Simon is captured and crucified on a massive water wheel in the castle's foundry. During this torturous ordeal, he experiences visions that reveal deeper truths about the nature of his world and the Storm King himself. These visions, interwoven with memories of his own past and glimpses of ancient Scythi civilization, show him the interconnected nature of all things. Rather than simply portraying Eneluki as an embodiment of evil, Williams reveals him as a tragic figure, a once noble being whose grief and rage at the destruction of his people twisted him into something monstrous. Through Simon's eyes, we see the fall of Asua, the burning of the Scythi's ancestral home, and the desperate choices that led to Eneluki's transformation. "I saw his face," Simon later tells his companions, including the Scythi princess Miriamel and the troll Binnebek. "There was hatred there, yes, but also such sorrow. Such terrible loneliness." This revelation transforms Simon's understanding of the conflict, suggesting that defeating the Storm King might require compassion as much as courage, a profound insight rarely found in epic fantasy of that era. This understanding deepens as Simon encounters other characters who blur the line between good and evil: the tortured Prince Joshua, the complex Scythi Prince Jeriki, and even the seemingly villainous Prirates, whose actions stem from a twisted but comprehensible desire for knowledge and power. Simon's journey through darkness becomes both literal and metaphorical, as he navigates not only the physical dangers of his quest, but also the moral complexities of a world where ancient grievances and present-day conflicts intertwine. His growing maturity is reflected in his ability to see beyond simple categories of good and evil, recognizing the shades of gray that color even the most seemingly straightforward choices. The relationship between Simon and Princess Miriamele forms one of the most nuanced and realistic romantic subplots in fantasy literature. Unlike the instant attractions common in the genre, their connection develops slowly, fraught with misunderstandings, class differences, and the pressures of their extraordinary circumstances. Miriamele, daughter of King Elias, has fled her father's corrupted court disguised as a commoner. Her journey parallels Simon's in many ways, as she too must shed her privileged perspective and confront harsh realities. Williams portrays her as a complex, sometimes contradictory character, brave yet vulnerable, principled yet capable of deception, royal yet increasingly questioning the value of bloodlines. Their relationship evolves through shared hardship rather than romantic cliches. When they reunite at the Stone of Farewell, both have changed dramatically from their first meeting. Simon has gained confidence and wisdom beyond his years, while Miriamele has developed independence and resilience. Yet their interactions remain awkward, colored by their different backgrounds and the trauma they've each endured. In one poignant scene, Simon presents Miriamele with the white arrow given to him by the Scythi prince Jeriki, his most precious possession. When she refuses it, recognizing its significance, he instead offers his sword and his service as her knight. This moment encapsulates their relationship, formal yet intimate, constrained by social roles yet transcending them through genuine feeling. Their romance culminates in the novel's final chapters after they face the ultimate test together in Green Angel Tower. Having confronted death and witnessed the fall of kingdoms, they find in each other not an escape from reality, but a reason to rebuild from the ashes. Their eventual union represents not just personal happiness, but the possibility of healing for the entire realm, a new beginning built on mutual respect rather than ancient hierarchies. Williams constructs a world where the past is never truly dead. It actively shapes the present through ancient grudges, forgotten magics, and buried secrets. The conflict between mortals and immortals stems from events centuries old, when humans first arrived in Ostenard and eventually drove the Scythi from their ancestral stronghold of Asua, now the Hayholt Castle. This historical depth gives the narrative unusual richness. The Storm King's vendetta against humanity isn't simply evil for evil's sake, it's rooted in genuine historical trauma. When Simon discovers that Inaluki was once a noble Scythi prince who turned to forbidden magic in a desperate attempt to save his people from human conquerors, it complicates the moral landscape significantly. Memory itself becomes a central theme, explored through characters like Camaras, once the greatest knight in the realm, now an amnesiac old man whose past holds crucial secrets. When his memories are finally restored through an ancient ritual, the revelation is devastating. Camaras is actually Prince Josua's father, having had an affair with King John's wife. This revelation shatters Josua's identity and purpose, forcing him to reconsider everything he thought he was fighting for. The Dwaros, subterranean beings with perfect memories, serve as living repositories of history, their underground cities containing records stretching back millennia. When Count Eolair and the Scythi Prince Jeriki visit Mezzatua, the abandoned Dwaro city beneath Hernisardark, they discover ancient knowledge that proves crucial to understanding the Storm King's plans. Williams suggests that both remembering and forgetting carry dangers. Those who cling too tightly to past glories or grievances, like the Norn Queen Utukku, become twisted by their refusal to accept change. Yet forgetting history entirely leaves people vulnerable to repeating its worst chapters. The novel argues for a middle path, acknowledging the past's influence while refusing to be imprisoned by it. Throughout the narrative, Williams examines how power, whether political, magical, or personal, tends to corrupt those who wield it. King Elias begins as a strong, capable ruler, but is gradually transformed into a tyrant through his possession of sorrow and manipulation by Prirates. The sword becomes both literal and metaphorical, representing how power can become an addiction that hollows out its wielder from within. Prirates himself embodies the corruption of knowledge divorced from ethics. As the king's red-robed alchemist, he pursues forbidden arts, not for any greater purpose, but simply because he can. "I want to tear open the universe and root about in the very guts of death and unbeing," he tells Elias, revealing the nihilistic impulse behind his scholarly facade. Even well-intentioned characters face corruption through power. Duke Isgrimnir, one of the most honorable figures in the story, finds himself compromised by military command, making brutal calculations about acceptable casualties. Princess Myrianele, witnessing how power has destroyed her father, fears taking the throne herself, telling Simon, "I've seen what ruling does to people." The three great swords represent the ultimate expression of this theme. Forged using forbidden words of making that bend the natural laws of the world, they contain tremendous power that inevitably warps those who wield them. In the novel's climactic revelation, the heroes discover that bringing the swords together, which they believed would defeat the Storm King, is actually exactly what Inaluki wants, as it will allow him to tear open the boundary between life and death. This subversion of the typical fantasy quest narrative, where gathering magical artifacts leads to victory, highlights William's sophisticated approach to power. The true resolution comes not through wielding greater force, but through Simon's radical act of compassion, choosing understanding over hatred, even when facing his greatest enemy. In contrast to many fantasy worlds where religion serves merely as background decoration, Williams creates a rich tapestry of spiritual beliefs that profoundly influence characters' actions and worldviews. The dominant Aidenite faith, clearly modeled on Christianity, exists alongside older pagan traditions from Hernestir, shamanistic practices of the Canuck trolls, and the mysterious spirituality of the immortal Sithi. Rather than presenting any single faith as definitively true or false, Williams explores how religious beliefs both sustain and constrain the characters who hold them. Father Strangyard, the one-eyed priest who accompanies Prince Joshua, finds genuine strength in his faith while acknowledging its limitations. When confronted with Sithi magic that contradicts church teachings, he struggles to reconcile his theological understanding with undeniable evidence. The Fire Dancers, a fanatical cult that emerges during the unnatural winter, demonstrate how spiritual yearning can be twisted toward destructive ends. Believing the Storm King to be a divine figure bringing cleansing fire to a corrupt world, they commit terrible atrocities in his name. Yet Williams portrays even these extremists with nuance, showing how their movement attracts those desperate for meaning in a world that seems to be ending. Perhaps most fascinating is how the immortal beings approach spirituality. The Sithi, despite their seemingly magical nature, have their own complex relationship with the divine. Jariki explains to Simon that the Sithi once had gods, but left them behind when they came to Ostenard from their original homeland across the Western Ocean. This creates a poignant sense of spiritual exile that parallels their physical displacement by humans. The novel ultimately suggests that faith, like memory, requires balance. Blind devotion leads to fanaticism, while complete skepticism leaves one without moral anchor. The wisest characters, like the witch woman Gallo, find ways to honor ancient traditions while adapting them to present realities, a lesson with clear relevance to our own world's religious conflicts. One of Williams' most progressive themes is his focus on characters traditionally marginalized in fantasy literature. Rather than limiting his perspective to kings and warriors, he elevates the importance of those often overlooked: servants, scholars, people with disabilities, and members of non-human races. Rachel the Dragon, the castle housekeeper who once scolded Simon for his laziness, becomes a quiet hero through her resourcefulness during the Hayholt's darkest days. Hiding in secret passages as the castle transforms under the Storm King's influence, she risks her life to help others, demonstrating that courage comes in many forms beyond battlefield prowess. Tiamak, a scholar from the swampland Ron, initially seems an unlikely hero, physically unimposing and more comfortable with books than weapons. Yet his knowledge proves crucial repeatedly, and his outsider perspective allows him to see connections others miss. When he rescues crucial documents from the League of the Skrull, he reflects that sometimes the smallest hands may do the greatest work, a sentiment that encapsulates William's approach to heroism. Binnabik, the small troll from the northern mountains, subverts fantasy stereotypes about his kind. Rather than being monstrous or simple-minded, he's among the most educated and philosophical characters in the story. His friendship with Simon demonstrates how cultural differences can be bridges rather than barriers when approached with mutual respect. Perhaps most striking is William's treatment of characters with disabilities. Father Strangyard's missing eye doesn't define him, nor does it magically enhance his other senses as fantasy tropes might suggest. It's simply part of who he is, sometimes a hindrance, but never his defining characteristic. Similarly, when Earl Guthwulf is blinded, his disability isn't portrayed as either divine punishment or spiritual enlightenment, but as a realistic challenge he must adapt to. Through these characters, Williams argues that true strength often comes from unexpected sources, and that societies which marginalize certain groups do so at their own peril, losing valuable perspectives and skills. Decades before climate fiction became prominent, Williams wove environmental themes throughout his epic. The unnatural winter gripping Oustinard serves as both literal plot element and powerful metaphor for humanity's disruption of natural cycles. The ancient Scythi lived in harmony with their environment, building cities that enhanced rather than dominated the landscape. Jau'i Tunakai, their hidden refuge in Aldworthy Forest, is described as being like cloth strung between trees, yet solid as any city, something that could be packed up and moved at any moment. This approach contrasts sharply with human settlements that clear forests, mine mountains, and fundamentally alter their surroundings. Williams connects environmental destruction to spiritual corruption through locations like the Warren Marshlands, where gaunts, insectoid monsters, multiply in unprecedented numbers as the natural balance falters. When Tiamat and his companions must rescue a friend from a gaunt nest, the horrific experience serves as a visceral reminder of what happens when ecological systems collapse. Even the Storm King's vendetta has environmental dimensions. The Scythi stronghold of Asua was built with profound respect for the land's natural energies, incorporating them into its design. When humans conquered it and built the Heihole to top its ruins, they disrupted these energies, creating dangerous instabilities that Inaluki now exploits for his return. The novel suggests that reconciliation between humans and nature is possible but requires humility and restraint. When Simon dreams of a white tree without leaves, a recurring vision that eventually leads him to understand crucial truths about Green Angel Tower, it represents both the damage done to the natural world and the possibility of renewal if humans learn to see themselves as part of nature rather than its masters. In the novel's climactic confrontation atop Green Angel Tower, Williams delivers his most profound message. Hatred, no matter how justified, ultimately destroys the hater more than the hated. When Simon finally faces the Storm King, who has possessed King Elias's body, he experiences a revelation that transforms the typical fantasy showdown into something far more nuanced. Through his connection to the Great Swords, Simon glimpses Inaluki's memories, seeing not just his rage, but the devastating loss and grief that fueled it. In that moment of understanding, Simon makes a choice that defies conventional heroic narratives. "I will fear you, but I will not hate you," he tells the Storm King. This act of compassion, rather than a final sword thrust or spell, becomes the pivotal moment in their confrontation. Williams suggests that breaking cycles of violence requires someone brave enough to step outside them, even at tremendous personal risk. Simon's choice echoes throughout the novel's conclusion, influencing how the survivors approach rebuilding their shattered world. When he and Miriamel eventually take the throne, they do so with a commitment to healing ancient wounds rather than avenging them. This theme extends to personal relationships as well. Miriamel must find compassion for her father even after his terrible betrayals. Joshua must forgive Camaris for the secret that shattered his identity. Count Eolar must accept that Princess Maeguin loved him silently for years, a revelation that comes only as she lies dying. The novel's final scenes, showing former enemies breaking bread together and planning a future that honors all peoples of Oustinard, offer a vision of reconciliation that feels earned rather than imposed. Williams acknowledges the difficulty of forgiveness without diminishing its necessity, creating an ending that satisfies emotionally while avoiding simplistic resolutions. To Green Angel Tower concludes one of fantasy literature's most influential series with appropriate grandeur and emotional depth. By weaving together themes of memory, power, faith, marginalization, environment, and compassion, Williams created a work that transcends genre conventions while honoring what makes fantasy meaningful. The novel's legacy can be seen in how it helped shift epic fantasy away from simplistic good versus evil narratives toward more nuanced explorations of morality and politics. Its influence extends from George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire to contemporary works by authors like Joe Abercrombie and Tasha Suri, who similarly explore the complexities of power and the perspectives of those traditionally marginalized. Perhaps most importantly, To Green Angel Tower demonstrates fantasy's unique ability to examine real-world issues through the lens of the imaginary. By creating distance through his secondary world, Williams allows readers to reconsider their assumptions about leadership, history, faith, and human nature. The novel reminds us that fantasy at its best isn't escapism, but a different angle of approach to our deepest questions. A mirror that, like Jariki's gift to Simon, shows us not just what we are, but what we might become. As Simon reflects near the story's end, looking at the ruins of Green Angel Tower, the world has changed and we have changed with it. In this simple observation lies the novel's lasting power, its recognition that transformation, whether of individuals or societies, comes at great cost, but offers the possibility of something better rising from the ashes of what came before.